TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of useful consciousness. Been brown so long, it looked like green to me. The amazing folk singer Uta Phillips once said, "The earth is not dying, she's being killed, and those who are killing her have addresses and names." In this broadcast, you will hear some of these names, researched by Jeffrey St. Clair, whose new book is entitled "Been Brown So Long It Looked Like Green to Me." And as we look closer, we see that the destruction of the environment is a bipartisan effort. St. Clair says that the title of his new book is a metaphor for our time. The book describes the grand awakening of the environmentalists during the Clinton years. They survived the nightmare of Reagan and Bush Sr. and their unremitting hostility to the environment. And here come Clinton and Gore. Gore, who proclaimed the environment as the defining issue of our time. Hopes were high. This was going to be the promised green age. But, Jeffrey St. Clair says, this was not to be.
In fact, by every available criteria, any criteria you want to apply to the environment, the 8 years of Clinton and Gore were worse than the 12 years of Reagan and Bush. It's indisputable. One of the reasons, of course, is because the environmentalists were not only spineless, they were complicit. One of the geniuses of the Clinton administration was that early on in their transition period, it was like a Major League Baseball draft or something. You know, they recruited 30 top-level environmental executives out of Big Green in D.C. into the Clinton-Gore administration. And these people did not work for green policies inside the Clinton-Gore administration. In fact, what you had was a phenomenon which Mark Dowie referred to as reverse access. In other words, these seasoned D.C. lobbyists started lobbying for the Clinton administration against the environmental groups that they used to work for. This is in marked contrast to what we see in the Bush administration, where they also will recruit and have recruited a lot of their top-level managers out of the oil industry, out of the timber industry, and put them into high-level positions inside the administration, where they have continued to lobby and pursue the interests of their former clients. That's not what happened during Clinton time. And we can look across the board. Oil drilling in Alaska, everyone is fixated upon ANWR. It's the great fetish of the environmental movement. Alex and I wrote, I think, the first and one of the only, it was never really followed up on by anyone else in the mainstream press, surprise, on the great oil giveaway of the Clinton administration, also in the Arctic, also right next to Prudhoe Bay, someplace you probably had never heard of, called the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. 24 million acres, the largest block of undeveloped wilderness land in the United States, perhaps in North America, adjacent to Prudhoe Bay. Its caribou herd was twice the size of the herd that's in ANWR that we hear so much about. The great river of the Arctic, the Alaskan Arctic, the Colville River, arcs through the middle of the petroleum reserve. Largest raptor nesting habitat in the Arctic. In one signature of the pen, Clinton opened up the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska for one of his favored political contributors, Atlantic Richfield Oil Company, and at the same time overturned a 30-year ban on the exportation of Alaskan crude oil, so that ARCO could take that oil and refine it in its big new refinery in Shanghai, China. ARCO's president, the CEO at the time, was Laudrick Cook, who had a birthday party on the lawn of the White House where Bill Clinton presented him with the birthday cake. Now, the interesting thing about the petroleum reserve was that after the great Teapot Dome scandal, which nearly brought down a presidency and sent Albert Fall and others to prison, the Teapot Dome was also a petroleum reserve. They transferred the petroleum reserves from the stealthy hands of the Interior Department to the United States Navy. And the Navy was one of the greatest environmental protectors we've ever seen. Under the law, the petroleum reserve could only be entered if it was a national emergency. World War II, the oil companies come knocking at the door. Surely this is a national emergency, and you can allow us to explore in the petroleum reserve in Alaska. No, the Navy said. Korean War came knocking again. No, not an emergency. Vietnam, no, not an emergency. The energy crisis of the 70s, no, the Navy wouldn't allow them in. Well, at this point, the oil companies shifted tactics, and they began lobbying the Reagan administration to transfer the authority from the Pentagon and the Navy back over to the Department of the Interior, which had really never seen an oil field that it didn't want to develop. And they successfully did that. But through the Reagan administration and Bush I, the oil companies were frustrated in their desires to even convince the Interior Department to open up the petroleum reserve. Then along came Clinton, and he did it with a stroke of the pen, with no objections from the mainstream environmental groups. In fact, with their complicity, Bruce Babbitt, the former CEO of the League of Conservation Voters, plucked into the top position in the Interior Department, was responsible for signing the order opening the petroleum reserve for oil leasing. He famously said that he was going to go up there and walk to each pond in the petroleum reserve, 24 million acres, and was going to personally certify that the oil development of the petroleum reserve would have only the most benign of environmental consequences. Kyoto. Again, you hear the Bush administration lambasted for its assaults on global warming, and I'll get to them in a minute. They are fearsome assaults. However, Kyoto was sabotaged from the beginning by the Clinton administration. In fact, by Al Gore himself, who had said that global warming was the great issue of our time. And even after this weak and compromised treaty was passed, the Clinton administration did not take one step to see its enforcement. So that when the Bush administration came into power, it was that much easier for them to just jettison and junk the treaty to begin with. I live in Oregon, and through the 80s and the 90s, the great battle in Oregon was over the ancient forest. And crazily enough, this was a grassroots movement because the national environmental groups never gave a damn about ancient forest. That put them into direct conflict with, the timber industry, a powerful lobby on the Hill, and with Democratic politicians like Tom Foley, who was Speaker of the House, and others, Alan Cranston here in California, Leza Coyne, the Democratic congressional delegation in Oregon. So they didn't want to get involved in it. The movement in the Pacific Northwest to save the ancient forest was led and won by radical, hardcore grassroots environmentalists, willing to blockade themselves in roads, up to their neck in stones, hanging from trees, chaining themselves to trees, and some innovative radical lawyers who were able to exploit the Endangered Species Act and dig out from inside the agency ecologist who had the goods on the fate of the northern spotted owl and 1,500 other species which were at risk of extinction if the logging of the ancient forest continued. And on top of that, they were able to convince a Reagan-appointed judge in Seattle, William Dwyer, who died last year, unfortunately, one of the great federal judges, to slap an injunction on all logging in ancient forest in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. Total victory. Took the timber industry to its knees in the belly of the beast. Along comes Clinton and Gore. Within 6 months, they had come up with a plan to, quote, resolve the crisis in the Northwest, called Option 9, which essentially legitimized the logging of ancient forest again. It was basically the same plan that the Bush 1 administration had come up with, that the environmentalists had gone to court, won an injunction stopping all logging on these federal lands. Then they called in the heads of the National Environmental Movement, gangrene as they're known, and said, if you don't go along with this, we're going to go to Congress and have them pass what's called a sufficiency rider, which will overturn the injunction and essentially shield all of our timber sales in old growth forest from any kind of legal challenge. Can't file suit under Endangered Species Act, National Forest Management Act, Clean Water Act, all of that. That's what we're going to do unless you go along with it. What did they do? Did they stand up for the spotted owl? No, they caved in to Bruce Babbitt, Gore, and Clinton, and they started logging the ancient forests in the Pacific Northwest again within a year of Clinton and Gore being in office. And you go down and down the line. Nuclear waste. Yucca Mountain. It wasn't the Bush administration's idea. You want to look at nuclear power. Al Gore. Supporting new nuclear power plants. Why? Well, because they're a tool to use against global warming. Trade agreements. Who gave us NAFTA? Who gave us the WTO? Clinton and Gore. Environmentalists were complicit on NAFTA. They were the environmental groups that went along with these free trade deals, which were horrible for workers, horrible for the environment, horrible for human rights. John Adams, the CEO of the Natural Resources Defense Council, actually bragged about his role in this, saying that, yes, we helped to break the back of the environmental opposition to NAFTA for the Clinton administration. What did they get for this? It's almost impossible to tell. They got a pat on the head, is really what they got. And then they got kicked in the shins. I remember Brock Evans, who used to be the chief lobbyist for the National Audubon Society, and through the Reagan and Bush era was one of the great lobbyists. Spine of steel. Total transformation when Clinton and Gore came into power. And Brock was quoted as saying, you know, the real difference between the two administrations, Bush 1 and Clinton, is that when I walk through the halls of the Department of Agriculture now, which runs the Forest Service, people call me by my first name. That basically explains it. It's kind of the, this is the, was the hush puppy, you know, lobbying technique of the Clinton administration. That's all it really took. Was to call them by their first names and invite them into weekly sessions with the vice president, and you not only neutered them, but you got them to essentially become a force against the grassroots activists who were fighting the WTI incinerator in West Virginia, or whether you were fighting the sellout of the Tongass National Forest in Alaska. So when the environmental groups come and warn you about the Bush administration and its unparalleled, unrivaled assaults on the environment. Remember, it's basically bullshit, because the Clinton administration and the environmental movement itself opened the door to the rampages. Now, that's not to say that there aren't rampages taking place. And let's deal with what's going on right now. What is the bill of indictment against the Bush administration? Well, let's give them credit for a kind of refreshing honesty in their approach to the environment. They're not really hiding behind too much. They want to deregulate all that they can. They want to privatize as much as of the public estate as they possibly can. They want to stop ongoing enforcement actions against their political cronies, and they've done it. They want to give as many gifts as they can to their political contributors, and what they can't give away, they want to allow them to steal. This is true. You can look at what's going on in the forest of Oregon, Washington, where you have Weyerhaeuser still, and this is ongoing from the Clinton administration, getting away with stealing 88,000 trees off the national forest every month. If you're a poor Hispanic living in northern New Mexico and you go out into the Santa Fe or the Carson National Forest to collect firewood to heat your adobe, you can go to jail for a year and you'll pay triple damages. If you're Weyerhaeuser of Louisiana Pacific and you steal 88,000 trees a month worth millions of dollars every month, you get a free pass. They want to operate in secret as much as possible. I'm going to talk a little bit later about Cheney's secret oil task force, but that's their strategy. When the whistle's blown on them from the inside, they're going to harass the whistleblowers and try and make it as uncomfortable as possible for them to continue doing their job. I interviewed an investigator looking into this timber theft issue in Oregon and Alaska, who had blown the whistle on the fraud. And what happened to him was he was taken out of Ketchikan, Alaska, where he was working, and he was transferred to Portland, Oregon, and put into a storage closet with a desk. And that's where he's working now, doing nothing. When your rampages are exposed in the press, mainly in the left-wing press or the radical environmental press, you lie about it, and you assail the patriotism of your critics. You accuse them of being eco-terrorists, and you pass laws to lock them up. I'll give you a case from Oregon. There is a young man by the name of Free, who got it into his head that SUVs were not such a great thing, and he particularly didn't like this SUV dealership that had polluted his neighborhood in Eugene. And he decided to light a couple of them on fire. And he did so. He was arrested, charged for an act of terrorism, and sent to prison for 8 years. On the other hand, there were two great arson fires a couple of years ago, both of them set by Forest Service employees that burned hundreds of thousands of acres, destroyed hundreds of homes. The damage, when you begin to calculate it up, is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. They both got 6 months in prison and a minor fine. One was an act of terrorism. The other was essentially a misdemeanor. So in Bush's war on the environment, you're either with us or you're against us. And they acted swiftly. It was a preemptive strike. Within the first 4 months, they had taken, through executive order, 200 rollbacks of longstanding environmental regulations. with the stroke of the pen, gone. They like to disguise their plans behind maliciously coded rhetoric that means the opposite of what it does. Come up with a plan that's going to log hundreds of thousands of old-growth forest a year, shield it from environmental regulations, shield it from citizen appeals and lawsuits. What do you call this plan? The Healthy Forest Initiative. Now, this is an example where your own senator, DiFi, has played an exceptionally malign role. I'll include our senator, Ron the Weenie Wyden, another Democrat. Ron Wyden is the leading recipient of Timber PAC money and Israeli PAC money. It's like the double whammy right there in Oregon. Who knew? Max Baucus from Montana. The three of those, three leading Democrats from the West, conspired with the Bush administration in this masquerade that ended up in the Healthy Forest Initiative. You're going to cut rules on the emissions of mercury from coal, from power plants, and you're going to call that the Clean Skies Initiative. Again, Democrats across the board in the House and the Senate went along with this scheme. There's a flashback has taken place with the Bush administration in that environmental policy is now being set by the Office of Management and Budget. And the Office of Management and Budget are not Keynesians in any respect other than the Pentagon under the Bush administration. So what you can't kill off outright through executive orders, you starve to death. You just simply cut the funding for it. The Endangered Species Act, one of the most hallowed laws that we have, we can thank Nixon for it. Our great environmental president, I don't know which one's greater. It's either Nixon or it's Ford. They neck and neck. The Bush administration has simply cut funding for the Endangered Species Act. They are, 4 years into the Bush administration, the only administration not to list a single species under the Endangered Species Act. Now, the Clinton administration listed some, but only because environmentalists sued them and federal judges demanded that they do so. But the environmentalists haven't even gotten that far yet with the Bush administration. Not a single species. Species that are on the list aren't doing any better because the Bush administration is saying, we don't have the money to designate critical habitat for you. We don't have the money to develop recovery plans for you. So you're just on your own. They're craven. They use 9/11 to impose limits on community right to know about toxins produced by chemical factories in your neighborhood. Now, this idea didn't come from Tom Ridge. It came from the chemical factories who said, well, you know, we don't like this right to know stuff because now if you have a computer, you've got access to the internet and you can deal with a clunky, could deal with a clunky site put out by the EPA called the TRI, the Toxic Release Inventory. You could type in your zip code and find out all of the plants within your zip code that are producing toxic waste, how much they're producing, and what the waste is, and what the long-term health consequences of that waste. The chemical companies never liked, they hated this. And they saw an opportunity to use 9/11 to say, hey, you know, this information could come into the hands of a terrorist, better take it off the web. The Bush administration agreed. How craven are they? In a story that we first broke on Counterpunch, Karl Rove ordered the EPA to conceal the environmental consequences and health risk of the 9/11 attacks on the people of New York City. That's how craven they are. So you say, who are these people in the Bush administration? And again, you might want to flash back to the Reagan era and a group of gentlemen, largely, who went under the rubric of the Sagebrush Rebels. Their patron saint was James Watt, and his sect, his monastery, was the Mountain States Legal Center in Colorado, which was funded by Adolph Coors, that great philanthropist. And who was Watt? Well, Watt just wasn't at war with the environment. He was a right-wing Christian on a mission. And one of my favorite Watt quotes is when he was confronted with his rampages against the environment by saying, you know, I mean, Reagan doesn't even want to go this far, does he? And Watt said, you know, I just can't be bothered to spend too much time thinking about the environment, or certainly not that much money on it, because I'm not convinced that the Earth is going to be around all that much longer. You see, he had an apocalyptic vision that is not all that different than the vision of some of the neocons who are now orchestrating the war in the Middle East and hope that it somehow converges at that great point of Megiddo and Armageddon can happen and they can experience the rapture. Watt had a vision of an environmental rapture, which he was obsessed with bringing about. Because he was a Republican, however, and looked like a wacko, he was largely cut off at the pass.
That was Jeffrey St. Clair, author of Been Brown So Long It Looked Like Green to Me. He was recorded by Jeff Blankfort at City Lights Books in San Francisco in February 2004. St. Clair is the co-author with Alexander Coburn of Whiteout and the co-editor of the muckraking newsletter Counterpunch. You can find more information on Jeffrey St. Clair's new book on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour tape or CD of Been Brown So Long It Looked Like Green to Me by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order really helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.